Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. Our guest today is Professor David Bolio, who joined the UMD faculty this year as the Ruth A. Myers Endowed Chair of American Indian Education. Previously, Dr. Bolio taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Arizona State University. From 1997 to 2001, he was the director of the Office of Indian Education for the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, D.C. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Bolio about his ongoing research, as well as the future of American Indian education.
Welcome to the program.
Great. Thank you, Eric. Nice to be here.
I wonder if you could start off talking a little bit about your background and kind of your journey to UMD.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I keep on saying that I've retired five times in order to get here. I left Minnesota back in, 97. Did a lot of work in Minnesota associated with Ruth and a number of other people working and focusing on improving opportunities for American Indians in terms of education in the state. We did a lot of work and did some time with Governor Carlson as a Commissioner of Human Rights, and then left to Washington, where I worked in the U.S. Department of Education, sort of managing federal programs for American Indians and working on President Clinton's executive order on American Indian Alaska Native Education. When I left that position about 2001, after George Bush got elected, I tried to get back to Minnesota and just sort of been skipping around the country trying to get back here. I've been teaching and working in a number of different universities focused on the education of American Indians from Milwaukee to Arizona. And so I'm back and find that this opportunity here is very attractive to sort of complete a career for me.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, too, about where you see the field of American Indian education and the progress we've made and what the future kind of holds.
I've been involved, I suppose, for 45 years. Mm-hmm. So I have somewhat of a depth of perspective about change and development. And I have a feeling that we've been on the decline for a significant period of time, particularly since we've been under the sort of genre and the policy of what is known as No Child Left Behind, high-stakes testing, the introduction of the Common Core, so on and so forth. At least there's an entire generation of American Indian students that have gone to school under that policy, and it's overshadowed all of the Indian education efforts, which are sort of trumped by that policy. And efforts to do new things in immersion, for example, is sort of invaded by that same regimen. Mm-hmm. The opportunity to do the types of things that are necessary for creating those kinds of educational institutions, they're not being supportive in a way that they should in order to accomplish that. In all of the areas, I think, that we've declined the most, it's the idea that that there should be self-determination and control in the development and implementation of education programs for their own children and people. Mm-hmm. We have really lost ground in that area. We used to, we were almost to a fault, made sure that Indian parents were involved in the educational programs of their children, were informed about what was happening, were contributing to that. We see that being avoided quite a bit. We see that control for tribal governments in terms of the educational institutions they run is really just managerial control. Very little opportunity to determine what the actual program should look like, what the curriculum should be, what the standards for teachers should be, all of that other area. The area where you really have control has sort of been declining. It's not that it ever really fully realized itself, but those are the ideas that began what was known as the Indian Education Movement way back, quite early actually, from places such as Rough Rock and Navajo Community College, now Dene College, to into the development of the Indian Education Act, the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act, Tribal Colleges Act, so forth. We haven't really had anything since that's been of that kind of an accomplishment. All of those sort of great beginnings have sort of been on the decline through regulation, through accreditation rubrics, through greater and greater control, and then also less resources to support programs. So that's my assessment. That's going to be an area of my focus while I'm here. I'm planning to write to talk a lot about the history that represents where we've been, in a sense. I spent a lot of time in the center of what you could call a lot of significant accomplishments in Indian education, from Sintay Gleshka College in Rosebud to efforts here in Minnesota, And that's not really a history of statutes and bureaucrats. That's a history of real people who were involved in creating change and developing institutions for Indian people in their own communities. There was a real sense of energy and purpose and vision for Indian education that really existed. And there doesn't seem to be the same sense anymore. To the extent that it does exist, it's a contrary notion. We're trying to blunt what's happening, what's occurring, and so forth.
So what do you think the answer to that is? I mean, does it happen at the top? Or, you know, we live in a very partisan society, but education, I almost feel, is the one area where there's not a huge divide, and everybody kind of seems to be on board with No Child Left Behind politically and things like that. So.
Well, it's true. Everybody wants their children to succeed, you know. And I think parents begin with that basic deposition that they really want their children to succeed, and they do everything to enable that to happen. And so a lot of the current policies are sold with that notion that this will make it happen, this will be the best thing. But to some extent, the best ideas were never really fully implemented. They still are viable. They still should be accomplished. And for those who are working in Indian education policy in a lot of areas, whether locally and nationally, they're focused on trying to create change. Once the No Child Left Behind statute is open for reauthorization and you can really get in there, I think there's a wide range of education interests and communities of people in this country that are opposed to it for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
And we've sort of taken the public out of public education, you know, and the ability of people to be engaged with their local schools and with their communities in the interest of their children.
Mm-hmm.
We need that type of a sort of a sense of education again. But it's amazing when you think about it. We've had some major accomplishments despite all of that business. In the 14 years that NCLB has existed, it's actually gotten worse by national statistics for Indian children. Mm-hmm. I mean, the alert's been sort of cried out in a number of reports. It's on the decline. It hasn't improved the results at all. Minnesota, as I'm told, coming back here, is at the bottom of the performance of Indian students in the state is at the bottom of other groups.
Huh.
And that that's tragic when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's surprising. In the old days, we used to say that there is no political party when it comes to Indian matters and so forth. The only party that mattered was the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you go for what you can get when you can get it, you know. And it was interesting. The Esther Martinez Native Language Preservation Act passed. It passed when I was on the board, and we, in fact, NIA was the organization that got behind sort of making that happen. And then I was president, and then Ryan Wilson became president, and it actually passed in 2006. What was interesting, it passed an all-Republican House and all-Republican Senate, and it was signed by George Bush in the era of English only and all that business. So you'd be surprised if you just keep on working at it,
right,
what you can accomplish, you know. Mm-hmm. And we need more. That statute's up for reauthorization now. There's another bill out, it's sort of commonly called the Tester Bill, but it links the immersion efforts to achievement. And if we allow those programs to become fully developed, the research tells us that you will accomplish academic achievement. So it's, in a sense, a strategy that you can have your cake and eat it too. Your language and your culture is something that's a treasured and of value to communities of people, and it's also a viable way in which to accomplish the achievement of academic content.
And how do you see language revitalization efforts?
One of the big incongruencies in policy is that all of the language statutes related to native language, immersion or otherwise, is in a agency outside of the education department and outside of the education statute.
Mm-hmm.
The new bill, Tester's bill, and what we've long advocated with NIA is to put a native language bill inside of the ESEA statute, and sort of by that virtue, not just the programs that it would support, but by the virtue of the policy that you can make the statute congruent to supporting those types of programs and supporting native language as the federal government does support. I mean, there's
right.
a major support for that, but it's primarily proclamation and not really
right.
getting behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So the further away you can get currently from the educational institutions out there, the more successful you're likely to be in creating a program that's going to be viable. But then you maybe not focused on academic achievement either right. as much. There are places, not here in the lower 48, so to speak, but Hawaii and other places where the emphasis has never been to link directly the preservation of native language and its viability with academic achievement. It's been create the context to save the language, and the rest will come along.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's the first focus, then interestingly, the children do quite well anyway and are excellent scholars. And because of the way in which one learns it, you know, you just become a better thinker and more interested. And there's a factor there that haven't really emphasized enough. It's a major thing to feel good about yourself and who you are for everybody, but for a young person in school, to have a solid sense of who you are as an Indian person, to be proud of who you are. That's a quality that makes you look forward to the future, makes you interested in the whole world around you, and provides a basis around which you can interpret your own creation, who you are, you know. And so it's the well-being factor that really matters to academic achievement.
Right.
Do children feel good about themselves and who they are? If they do, somehow they can accomplish anything. You can do anything, go anywhere, you know. And they take their sense of who they are in Indianness as they see it, anywhere they in the world, you know. That's what's missing. We knew that that was the magic pill, so to speak, long ago. And the institutions would sort of provide education, government policy, everything has walked away from that, in my view.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanada, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest is Professor David Bolio, who joined the UMD faculty this year as the new Ruth A. Myers Endowed Chair of American Indian Education. He has taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Arizona State University. From 1997 to 2001, he was the director of the Office of Indian Education for the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your current research project.
I've got two. One is what we've been kind of been talking about, in a way. I've had a sort of a personal and intimate involvement in the history of Indian education policy. It's sort of thinking about it, researching it, doing it, working on statutes, doing a lot of different positions. And I have in that work a lot of friends that I've come to know, colleagues all over the country. In fact, that's how it was done. You know, there was this sort of community of people. So I'm focused on, I've done a lot of the research. I've interviewed, well, 50-some people already. Of course, got all the documentary evidence gathered and so forth. So I'm into the process of writing and filling up some holes. But what I want to do is write a book on the history of the people, ideas, and organizations that were behind part of the Indian education movement and talk about that story. Most of our histories are histories of statutes and bureaucrats. And that's not very interesting in the first place, and it's not an accurate story at all, you know. And by the time a statute is created and a bureaucrat gets a hold of it, it's long left the vision of its original intention or purpose, you know. And so I'm going to try to write that story. It's a joy to write and difficult because to capture the sense of friendship and community that was really a part of it is sometimes hard to contain, you know, without putting yourself in the middle of the story or making it so academically and scholarly that you lose that sense, you know. So I'm working on that process and trying to do that writing. I've done some things already that sort of are in that genre, this sort of practice, you know.
Right.
A couple of articles and so forth. When I talk about that project, being here in Duluth and at the University of Minnesota Duluth and being the Ruth Myers Endowed Professor is perfect. Ruth was a great part of that whole effort and movement in this state and in the country. I first met her in 1979 in Colorado in what was called the Indian Education Project Task Force of the States, the Education Commission of the States. Did to look at how state governments were dealing with Indian education issues, and so worked with her until she passed away after I had left to go to Washington, D.C. So it's a good place to be. When they had the reception here, it was a great reunion of the kind of people that I want to write about and talk about, you know, so it was nice to see those people here. The other is a personal story, but it's really expanded, and that's the story of Finding Little Crow. I call it Finding Little Crow. I think in 1969, I was a young kid at the University of Minnesota. I think it was into my last year at the university. I was working at Historical Society, and they asked me to go get this box. Mm-hmm. And so I did. I didn't know what was in it. I had a number and a description. I got it, and I brought it to the photography section. And, of course, they asked me to bring a crowbar along. I opened up the box, and there inside that box was the scalp, the arm bones, and the skull of Little Crow, the leader of the Dakota War in Minnesota. Well, I was amazed, of course, that that was in the box. It sort of shocked me, and I asked...
They didn't give you any kind of...
No clue, nothing at all, They had set up a light table with the, the camera above it and the lights positioned to illuminate the object that was going to be photographed. And so I just sort of merrily went about my business, and there it was. And so I had to remove them one at a time. But there was a man in the room from Flandreau, South Dakota, who represented Jess Wakeman, the only living grandson of Little Crow, who was there to find out if the remains still existed. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was pursuing the burial of his grandfather, which he had begun since the centennial. Of
and it was his grandfather, not his great-grandfather.
No, his grandfather, He was in his 80s at the time.
Yeah.
He had pursued that since the Dakota War centennial in 1962. Mm-hmm. And to the resistance of the State Historical Society, I was amazed at that whole thing. I couldn't conceive of the idea, quite honestly. And was angry. If you you realize what was happening with Indian people in the community of Minneapolis-St. Paul at the time, and the energy that was there, and I was a student, I decided I'd wanted to find out what happened. And I didn't think I'd find anything, but I did. Mm-hmm. I was amazed at that process, did my own research, wrote it up, and used what I found to try to advocate for his burial, which in fact happened. And I got a nice letter from Agnes Ross, the tribal president, thanking me for whatever efforts I had done in that. But I had learned something by that whole process that I could take charge of my own education. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to be dependent upon anybody for sitting in a classroom, you know, blindly listening to people, writing down notes, and then giving it back on a test. I actually went out and searched for things. I searched my own family. I'm an enrollee at the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe from White Earth, and so I got busy. I started researching my own father's family, my own people, and a whole new world opened up for me. It's what got me started, you know, in my work. And so I'm going to write the story, rewrite it, because it was really an undergrad paper. So I decided I'm going to write a larger book on the topic of finding Little Crow. You know, he was displayed in the State Historical Society, and to some extent he was the first mascot. See, when I asked, you know, why do you keep him? Why won't you let this guy bury his grandfather? The guy that was in charge told me, we own him.
Oof.
So I said, this idea of ownership of a human being, you know, in the collections of a museum, the ownership of the image of American Indians, et cetera, is a larger topic that I'd like to write about.
Right, and it's something, like you say, I mean, it plays into the struggles against, like, things like the Washington Redskins mascot.
All of it. And it plays also to that topic we were talking about a little bit earlier about the well-being of Indian children. The surround that Indian children have about who they are in this society is incredibly negative and locked up into a myth about this country's history.
So when they buried him then, what was it, right away, or?
It was in 1971, towards the fall. It was 108 years after he had been killed, and he had been sort of sitting in a makeshift purgatory in the vault of the State Historical Society. He was put on display almost immediately in the library of the Historical Society, which, by the way, happened to be located in the state capitol building. So, in a sense, Little Crow's on display in our state capitol for a period of time.
Yeah.
Both Jess Wakeman and a half-sister, had visited the Historical Society, and there they saw him and complained.
So it was relatively recent that he was displayed.
No, they found him in the 1915. Been to...
But still a ways after the war, you know.
Jess had been off to Carlisle, and he became, as his father was, the head of the YMCA among the Dakota people. And after he returned from Carlisle. So at any rate, that's an interesting history, you know, that whole business. But it's a long story, mm-hmm. you know, and I do go on sometimes. You know, you have to jump in and just tell me, hey.
You know, it's interesting, too, when we talk about, you know, Native history. I think so much is, like you've been talking about, so much of it is written from the policy standpoint, which is all interesting and important, but it's these little stories and just taking, you know, this one story of these remains, it really brings out a lot of this other stuff that also brings in the policy, but it also talks about these different eras and even these contemporary things we're dealing with. So.
Yeah, there was one story that sort of continued. You know, this is a story that actually keeps on giving. But I was on the board of the St. Paul Foundation at one time, and I was about to become Commissioner of Human Rights, and a woman came to interview me. And they were going to do the annual report a little bit different. And so she wanted to get a little, you know, something interesting about me. So she asked me, how did I get involved with Indian Affairs? And so I told her that after I pointed out that picture that I had of that letter from the Agnes Ross of Flandreau regarding Little Crow and what I had done. Anyway, I says, you know, it's interesting that's what got me involved and so forth, as I just told you. Mm-hmm. But I went on to tell her the story, and I got quite graphic about it. It's almost too hard to tell. And
right.
So through a part of the story, I mentioned about this man in Hutchinson whose name was Dr. Benjamin putting the head of Little Crow into a kettle of lime to remove the flesh to save the skull. For history's sake, it was his intention to donate it. Mm-hmm. To the Historical Society. He was, he actually rescued it from the children and others who were playing with it and decided he would sort of preserve it by saving the skull. At any rate, as I told the story, the woman cried and she was upset. I stopped immediately and I said, I'm sorry, I think I've offended you. It's a little bit graphic and I didn't mean to go on like that. I says, I do get carried away. And, I suddenly realized why she was crying. It wasn't that, actually. Her last name was Benjamin. And she was a great-granddaughter of the man I was talking about. Oh. Or at least a great-great. And she knew of him quite well. And she said, yes, we know that story, and I'm quite embarrassed by it. And I sort of sat back in my chair, and I felt, holy smokes. I said, imagine that. I said, I looked at her and I said, you know, history is not an abstraction. It actually happened to real people, mm-hmm. you know. And I said, thought to myself, holy, it's amazing. Here you have two people who, in fact, three, if you include the most relevant, Little Crow's family, mm-hmm. Who are at opposite ends of the perception of the same event, mm-hmm. you know. And yet there's something that the woman felt bad about, didn't like, was upset about at the same time, you know. So it's an interesting issue, you know, thinking about it.
I guess maybe to wrap up, we'll maybe ask you about being back in Minnesota and growing up here, how that kind of shaped your career. And also to think of... ask you about too, as you mentioned with the Little Crow, you know, going to college in the late 60s and how Minneapolis specifically in the late 60s and the activism and early 70s, how that shaped you kind of going forward.
It shaped almost everything in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually went to the University of Minnesota in 1966 as a freshman. I had a state Indian scholarship grant to go, and I had a full ride. You know what it was? $340 a year to go to college, and I thought it was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. There were 38 of us at the university, and in those years from 66 through 70, when I finally graduated, it was an amazing time. The number of Indian students steadily increased. Mm. The American Indian Student Association was formed. From as a more activist organization from what was used to be the Indian Student Council from the 50s as an organization had existed there. The first Department of American Indian Studies, and I took courses in that first department. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, when I first showed up in the class, somebody asked for a show of hands of who everybody who's Indian, raise their hand. And nobody had ever asked me that.
Huh.
And so I raised my hand slowly. as I was watching everyone else, and they did too. And so I kind of thought that that's what was happening. Everybody mm-hmm. was slowly raising their hand to declare, I am Indian.
Yeah.
And it was happening in that fashion and in the community and everywhere else, both figuratively and literally. And it was exciting. It gave us opportunities and things that sort of formed a basis or a vision for a purpose of education.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been riding that surf wave, or that sort of, it's a wave, you know, it's like surfing in a sense. It's been incredible momentum and energy from that time. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And we all took off. I went to graduate school with about 20 Indian graduate students in 1970, and there was programs at Penn State, Harvard, and Arizona State as well. And all of us sort of went through graduate school with a sense that we were going to be, we were going to do things mm-hmm. for Indian people. We didn't know what it was, but we knew we were going to, and we all considered our education, what we're hearing and learning, in the context of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting. That's what really was, it felt like. And I still got the same energy from that time, tell you the truth. And so I think that's kind of, that was an important time, absolutely. I love to teach,
mm-hmm.
and I have an opportunity to teach here,
mm-hmm.
and to sort of do that. I love to tell stories, and I love to talk about Indian education policy and history and so forth, and I like to engage students who have such interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad to have you here at UMD, and thanks for coming in and talking about your experiences.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah. Good to be back home, actually.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guest, Professor David Bolio, who joined the UMD faculty this year as the new Ruth A. Myers Endowed Chair in American Indian Education.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanida. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of the program, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Ojibwe Stories Gaga Nunanida is produced by KUMD and by the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes. More information at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaga Nunanida is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.